who had worked with the deterrent. She hoped to find out the truth about me and any others like us, and she could steal 3 decades of information gathered during the hunt for the deterrent. Harris's mind had given her the break she needed, possibly a shortcut. Now, she had to find Cressida Lofthouse.
Chapter 37, November 22nd, 1991. After Brixton, I saw Apos once more. 10 years ago. 10 years ago tonight. This is the first time I've even looked at this diary since then. I brought the bottle of J&B upstairs, prized up the floorboard under the rug, brushed the dust and 3 desiccated spiders off the box, poured my first glass and started reading. Now I'm a little tipsy. And sad. If anyone ever reads this and blows the whistle, there'll be such a scandal. I'd love to see Hopkins and Carstairs' faces. It almost certainly won't be during my lifetime, unfortunately, so I doubt they will be around to face the consequences. Every year I think about what happened. Remember that night a decade ago. Go over everything that was said and done. Afterwards, no one ever saw Abos again. The official story is that he disappeared in the storms. Missing, presumed dead, was how the military spokesman put it. We've all seen that clip 100 times. And we've all read the articles and books, watched the documentaries, heard the radio shows. So many theories. Some of them advanced so forcefully and plausibly that I find myself half believing them. None of them anywhere near the truth. I know it wasn't the storms. He's not dead. I live here alone now, diary. Father died in his sleep 6 years ago. After Abos had gone, station paid him for 12 months before pensioning him off and closing the department. Well, it wasn't closed completely. Mike Ainsley is still there. Some kind of research continues. Roger went back to America, leaving his wife and child. McKean returned to Scotland, where he took a research post, only to drown in a fishing accident within 6 months. As father's next of kin, I have the house, a small government pension, and the savings he and mother had built up. I have enough to get by. I don't work anymore, but I volunteer at the local library. A spinster librarian at 41. I could be rather wealthy if I were paid royalties for the book based on my reports when I was at station. When it was first published, in 1983, it was the fastest-selling book in history. The Deterrent, the inside story of Britain's superhero, by H.T. Beauthorpe, is a bestseller even now. As the only official account written by someone attached to the Deterrent's scientific team, the mysterious H.T. Beauthorpe, whoever that is, it's considered the most accurate account of Britain's only superhero. Oh, the whole thing is poppycock. A fabrication. A tissue of lies. Like all good lies, it's partially based on the truth. Most of the descriptions of the inside of station, the laboratory, and Abos himself are lifted word for word from the notes I handed in every week to Hopkins. The location and name of the facility have been redacted, naturally. When it comes to the deterrent's origins, the book is one big red herring. The heavy hints about genetic research leading to the development of a super warrior? I suppose Hopkins thought it would be more believable than the truth. And I doubt the British government wants anyone to know that they found their superhero lying around in the middle of London. They want every other nation to believe, even now, that we might create an army of deterrents to replace Abos. After 10 years, I wonder if anyone is still falling for that. This is the story told by H.T. Beauthorpe. In 1976, a British soldier, badly wounded in an explosion, was flown to a secret facility where new genetic and biomechanical techniques had been developed after the Second World War. The brightest and best scientists from the country had come up with ways of enhancing physical strength and mental capabilities, but the techniques were unproven and potentially dangerous. They had not yet reached the stage where they would be prepared to test anything on humans. The dying soldier's arrival, an individual with no family, gave them that opportunity. Without their intervention, without attempting to use a combination of these untested procedures, the man would die. They operated. The description of the operation lasts a whole chapter in the book, which is impressive since it never happened. The book is written for the general public, so scientists studying it, hoping to find a hint of how the human brain might be rewired to enable it to move objects as big as Challenger trucks, must have been disappointed. It was full of meaningless twaddle, such as, "The chief surgeon, after 28 hours without rest, faced surely the most delicate procedure ever attempted on a human brain. Dr. G needed to manipulate synaptic receptors in such a way that they could forge new, unique connections between parts of the brain that had previously been unable to communicate with each other. Epigenetic creation is still a field which remains unknown outside the secret labs of the Miltech team." But synaptic receptors, epigenetic creation, drivel and tosh. Miltech is a fantasy too, doesn't exist. Still, on the face of it, a hidden rural laboratory seems more plausible than an underground complex, so close to the Liverpool Street Underground that in some of its corridors you can put your hands on the wall and feel the vibrations of the tube trains as they pass. The rest of the book is mostly nonsense. National security is invoked on page one. Details have been changed, locations moved, real names concealed, blah, blah, blah. Hilarious, really. As that means everything that follows could be fiction. Which, for the main part, it is. The patriotic jingoism really got my goat, I must admit it. The deterrent of the book is such a bore once he starts talking, full of awful soundbites about Queen and country. I skimmed those parts. They used my notes about teaching sessions almost verbatim, although there's an extra chapter detailing the months when he couldn't speak yet at all. Their fictional injured soldier suffered such extensive brain damage that he needed to learn to talk again. I, or rather H.T. Beauthorpe, gradually drew out his latent abilities over the course of about 60 pages, introducing him to the Peter and Jane books and taking him out for occasional walks. It's all very heartwarming. The bulk of the book is a celebration of all the amazing feats performed by the deterrent between October 6, 1979 and November 21, 1981. Most of these are in the public domain already, but the book adds little details and tedious quotes from the deterrent. "I was proud to lend a hand to the Air Force and locate the terrorist group, which was violently opposed to our entire way of life. After eliminating the threat, we celebrated with a flask of tea, a taste of home out in the desert." Only one sentence about the Brixton riots. "I helped police control the rioters and looters before being called away by MI5 to deal with a far more dangerous situation, which even now I cannot reveal." As far as memory serves, the far more dangerous situation in question involved Abos hovering outside my bedroom window. I can see why MI5 wouldn't want to reveal that. As for the events of November 23rd, 1981, the last, comparatively short chapter covers that. A well-documented night of freak weather provided Station with enough of a smokescreen to suggest why no one has seen the deterrent since that night. In a 5-hour period, the United Kingdom was hit by the highest amount of tornadoes ever experienced by a European country. None of them were particularly strong, but during the evening, the middle of the country from North Wales across to Norfolk was visited by 105 reported tornadoes. As this is a matter of public record, it's easy enough for the book to hint that such a freak occurrence in our national weather system may not have been entirely natural. According to the book, the deterrent left London at 7 p.m. to investigate the tornado reports. He flew northeast to Norfolk, where the highest confluence of storms had been reported. He never returned. Beauthorpe leaves it to the reader to extrapolate. In the years following the deterrent's disappearance, a deluge of books and magazine articles, plus Hollywood's various attempts to tell the story, have advanced many fantastical theories. All choose between the same three possibilities. The deterrent is either 1. Dead. 2. Held by persons unknown. Or 3. Intentionally missing. 2 is surprisingly popular, considering the fact that Abos has superpowers. If a group out there had the wherewithal to defeat him, surely the world would have heard more from them since. The books suggesting alien intervention sell remarkably well. 1 and 3 are the only options that make any kind of sense. According to the book, the last person to see the deterrent alive was one Corporal Evan Todd. Corporal Todd had this to say. "He told me he'd be back by 9:30 as some of the boys were showing The Great Escape in the mess, and it was one of his favourite films. He was in good spirits, he was positive, he was motivated, full of energy, as always. We exchanged salutes at the door and then he took off. I watched him go. I never got tired of watching that. Seeing a man fly, incredible. When he didn't come back for the film, I knew something was wrong. We still haven't got over it. Any of the squad, we're all gutted. I still can't believe I'm the last person who ever saw that fine soldier alive. That's because you're not, Todd. I am. And trust me, he wasn't planning on going anywhere near any hurricanes. What actually happened was far stranger, far more disturbing than that. And far sadder. I suppose part of the reason it's taken me nearly 10 years to write about that night is because it nearly ruined my feelings about Abos forever. It took a long time to even start thinking about what happened. And it wasn't as if I could speak to anyone. I don't want to go into detail about everything, even now. I know it's supposed to be cathartic, that we're supposed to face our traumatic memories in the interests of good mental health. I've read the books. But at heart, I'm an old-fashioned kind of girl. Some things are better left locked away. This account will be the only time I'll look back fully. I'll make myself remember everything that happened, even if I won't share all of it. Not even with you, dear diary. There's one last reason I've hesitated to write what I'm about to write. When this diary finally comes to light, it will confirm the truth of a particularly lurid thread of newspaper stories that dogged the deterrent. Stories that were ignored by some papers, but that proved irresistible to the tabloids. I'm sure most people dismissed them as nonsense, given the clean-cut, old-fashionedly gallant image always enjoyed by Abos. I remember the first story clearly. It was on the A-board, outside my local newsagent, early in 1980. My super sex session with the deterrent. I walked into the shop in a daze and bought the paper, sitting in a coffee shop to read it. Large photographs of the lady in question dominated the story. Mandy Harbin was pictured in various stages of undress, doing her best to imitate the pouty models who appeared on other pages of the same rag. Her story seemed to be nothing more than a transparent attempt by a busty young girl with no prospects to make money, and perhaps launch a career at the sordid end of the modelling business. Ms. Harbin claimed that the deterrent had singled her out whilst signing autographs after rescuing a crane operator from almost certain death. A photograph reprinted in the paper clearly shows Mandy Harbin holding out her arm for Abos to sign. They had met, there was no doubt about that. The part of the story that stretched credulity was the subsequent late-night visit to her maisonette. She claims to have whispered her address to him, where they, in her words, made love, first on the bed, then in the shower, then on the stairs. It was romantic. The bed, the shower, and the stairs. Romantic indeed. I remember stuffing the paper into the first bin I saw. It never occurred to me that there might be even a grain of truth in it. Even when other women came forward, I refused to believe it. Their stories were remarkably similar. The deterrent had visited them at night after he had met them at one event or another. Some of the women took the same route as Miss Harbin, appearing in tabloids in their underwear, but others kept their clothes on, perhaps in an attempt to seem more credible. None of them had witnesses to corroborate their stories. Apparently, this 7-foot man could get into their bedrooms without being seen by a single neighbour. One memorable claim came from a student who lived in a house shared with 5 others, none of whom saw anything. Since the main newspaper printing the stories, which I still can't bring myself to name, was offering cash for women to come forward, the deterrence press office didn't even bother responding to them. But the claims didn't go away. Superstar knocked me up. Super baby due in September. Even the pill couldn't stop him. The paper followed her through each trimester to its inevitable conclusion. In September, we were treated to the sight of a bonny baby in the arms of a proud-looking Mandy. A healthy, completely normal baby. The press looked in on her now and then in the years following. But, in the absence of pictures of the toddler flying around the house or lifting cars over his head, they lost interest. Mandy gradually disappeared from the magazines and the chat shows, as did the other women who had claimed the deterrent to be the father of their children. It all looked like a publicity stunt by the gutter press, involving the exploitation of some desperate women. Never, not even for a moment, did I suspect it was true. Then, Abos came to me. I've sipped too much whiskey writing this. I'll continue tomorrow with a clearer head. Chapter 38. November 23rd, 1991. That's better. It's wonderful the positive effect a bowl of porridge and a strong cup of Assam can have. No more prevarication, Chris. Today marks the 10th anniversary of the last time I saw him. I imagine a lot of people remember that night for another reason. The unnatural weather. London was expecting a few of the freak tornadoes, so I had decided on an early night with a good book and a mug of cocoa. There's nothing better than curling up in a warm bed while a storm rages outside. I must have fallen asleep while reading, because when I woke up, just after midnight, the book was in my hand and my bedside light was still on. I went to the bathroom and cleaned my teeth. As I was about to get into bed, I had the same feeling I'd had that night in April, the night of the Brixton riot. I stood still for a few moments and convinced myself I was just being silly. I got into bed and turned out the light. I lay there with my eyes open and my heart thumping. Then I got up again, crossed the room, and before I could think too hard about what I was doing, drew the curtains apart. He was there. Eventually, I opened the window. "Hello, Chris." He looked like an angel floating there, his golden eyes turned silver by the moonlight. He smiled, a small, tentative smile. "Hello, Abos." I didn't know what to say. If Station knew he was here, I was likely to spend the rest of my life locked up in an institution, but I couldn't send him away. "Wait there," I said. "I'll let you in." I went to close the window, intending to go to the back door. He stopped me, turned sideways, and entered the room head first as I backed away in surprise. Abos landed lightly on the carpet, his head close to the ceiling. I put out my hand. His smile deepened and he shook it. I smiled too, remembering how I had taught him this most British form of greeting. "Chris, I have waited so long." I took his hand again and held it, looking up at that face I remembered so well. "I'm sorry, Abos. I was not allowed to see you." "I know. Mr. Carstairs said you were too busy. He said I could have other treats. He let me have lots, but I still asked for you. He got angry and I had to stop asking. I pretended to forget you. That made him happy, but I didn't forget, Cress." It was the longest speech I had ever heard from Abos. Much of it didn't make sense. Treats. And it seemed he wasn't just respectful, but afraid of Carstairs. Father's drugs had been used to place Abos in some sort of dependent relationship with that twisted man. I bristled at the idea and decided it was time to tell Abos the truth. But what he did next stopped me. He let go of my hand and pulled his jumper over his head. He was bare-chested beneath. I suddenly became very aware that I was only wearing a cotton nightie. He took my hand again and placed it on his chest, his solid, muscled chest. I swallowed hard. "Abos, listen to me. The way Carstairs has been teaching you, the life you lead, it's not..." I stopped speaking because Abos was kissing me. For half a second I felt myself respond, a physical reaction to this beautiful man, but I, of all people, knew he was far from human. For most of a decade I had watched scientists try to take readings and get samples from what looked like a large glass cylinder with some mouldy soup inside it. I had seen him change from his mushy pea state and become a superior copy of Roger. I had watched him learn our language and our ways, then seen how he was manipulated and controlled by the very people who should have been helping and supporting him. There was no way I could let this happen. My body wanted to respond, but I knew it would be a huge mistake. I put both hands on his chest and pushed him gently but firmly away. He took a small step back and looked at me. "No," I said. I looked into his eyes and saw something that scared me. I knew he had heard me, but it was as if what I had said hadn't registered. "No, Abos," I said, more loudly this time. I knew where I'd seen that look before. It was the same look Roger had given me outside the pub that night. The same look Abos had given me in front of Carstairs that once, excruciating occasion when he had stared at my body rather than my face. It was a look of pure sexual desire. Abos reached forwards, took the top of my nightie in his hands and tore it in two. I stumbled backwards, naked, beginning to panic. He followed, picked me up and lay me on the bed, his hands while my breasts, Then he was climbing onto the bed next to me, undoing his belt. He bent over me and kissed me again. He tried to kiss me with his mouth open, his tongue darting straight into my mouth. I'd been kissed like that just once before, at school, behind, would you believe it, the bike sheds. The memory of that bit of adolescent fumbling came into my mind as Abos's knee forced my legs apart. Something had just become very clear to me. I slapped Abos as hard as I could across his face. He paused for a second and looked at me, the tiniest bit of confusion registering along with his lust. "Abos, stop this! Do you care about me? Do you care about me at all?" He pushed himself up and off me. "Of course, Cress. Yes, you know I do. Then you must stop this. If you care about me, you need to stop and we need to talk." He looked crestfallen. The glaze of lust faded and then disappeared as he looked at my expression, the way I was holding my arms across my breasts. I remembered his early lessons when he talked about the language of the body. If he was as good at reading it as he claimed, he could hardly miss the signs I was giving off now. He began doing up his belt. I walked quickly to the door and put on my dressing gown, before sitting back on the bed. I patted the space next to me, still trembling with shock and adrenaline. I attempted to control my breathing and settle my mind. My own feelings about what had just happened could wait until later. Right now I wanted to make a dent in Carstairs' conditioning. I was determined to prevent Abos becoming a superpowered sexual predator, for the sake of women everywhere, and for his own sake. "Put your clothes back on and sit down, Abos." He did as he was told, but still looked puzzled about what was happening. He had obviously been expecting me to respond positively to his sexual overtures and was confused by my adverse reaction. An intuition came to me. "Abos, these treats and rewards you mentioned, are they women?" He nodded, without a hint of guile. "Yes. Mr. Carstairs say I deserve a treat because I work so hard." "So, when you go on missions, how do you find these treats, these women? Does Mr. Carstairs find them for you?" He nodded. "Usually. Some women ask me to visit them." It wasn't hard to believe that women would throw themselves at him. I tried to marshal my thoughts, wondering how long the drugs Carstairs administered were effective. According to the chart I'd seen, Abos took his vitamin mix daily at 8 a.m. It was now 12:25. 16.5 hours since his last dose. 7.5 until his next. If he still slept for 4 to 6 hours a night, it was possible that, this late, he might be more clear-headed. I couldn't hope to undo 2.5 years of chemical and psychological interference, but I might sow a seed of doubt. What actually happened was something I hadn't anticipated. Abos happily admitted to having sex with hundreds of women. When I asked about Mandy Harbin's baby, he looked blank. A few more gentle questions, and it was clear that he didn't really understand that sexual intercourse could lead to pregnancy. In Mandy's case, if she was now to be believed, despite the fact she was on the pill. How many other women might have been impregnated if contraception couldn't stop him? I moved the conversation on to consent. This was an utterly unfamiliar concept to Abos. In his opinion, every woman wanted to have sex with him. He had no doubt about it. All his experience had confirmed it. Then he admitted something that made my blood run cold. I wasn't the first to resist him. But Carstairs had assured him that a little physical foreplay was sometimes to be expected. I felt sick. Had he raped women? Carstairs had objectified the opposite sex so thoroughly in Abos's mind that he regarded them merely as vessels for his pleasure, after he had fulfilled whatever tasks his masters had asked of him. The only reason it seems that Carstairs hadn't succeeded completely in his attempt to ensnare Abos's mind entirely was me. Or rather, the attitude towards me, embedded in Abos's consciousness long before Carstairs turned up. As far as Abos was concerned, I was the equal of all other human beings he had worked with. In some ways he deferred to me, as I was his teacher. My authority had been diminished when our meetings were stopped, as Carstairs formulated his scheme to control Abos, but he had underestimated the strength of that initial connection. Sitting on the end of my bed, Abos admitted that he had indulged in all the sexual rewards offered to him, hoping they would one day lead back to me. Rather dryly, I pointed out that his ultimate superior, the head of our government, was a woman. Did he consider her to be inferior, available as a treat, perhaps, despite the fact that she was Carstairs' superior? He visibly struggled with the logical disconnect between what had been strongly suggested under the influence of mind-altering drugs and what I was telling him now, that all women should be treated the same as men, that explicit consent and mutual respect must be present before any sexual relationship can begin between adults. When he was at his most confused, literally holding his head in his hands, I told him about the drugs Father had formulated to control him. I knew this was likely to lead to me being permanently sectioned by station, but I had to tell him he was being chemically manipulated, that his freedom was an illusion. He was silent for a long time. I told him my theory. Abos, when I met you, you were a baby, an infant, not a human infant, because your body was fully grown and you could reason and speak, but an infant of, well, whatever species you are. While I was teaching you, you showed a capacity to learn. You were curious. You began to mature. But even if your mental faculties develop far faster than humans, I believe emotionally you were like a small child. Now the way you're behaving, the way you've been encouraged to behave, is like a male adolescent, an exaggerated, more selfish version of an adolescent. You act as if the world exists for your gratification. Your view of life centers around yourself, and that's very common in a 13-year-old human, but it's not a true picture. Everyone has the same rights as you, the right to live, learn, be happy, the right to choose. He lifted his head and looked at me, his golden eyes full of tears. Cress, don't you want me? I squeezed his shoulder in as close to a maternal way as I could manage. That's not the point. You assumed I did. You didn't respect my right to a choice. He stood up. I'm sorry, Cress. He looked the model of a repentant adolescent. I half expected him to stick his bottom lip out. I felt a wave of sympathy for him. Whoever, whatever he was, Abos did not deserve the treatment he had received. No, I said. It's I who should apologize. On behalf of my father, my government, and my country. You should never have had to suffer this. What do I do now? He looked at me and waited. The most powerful being on the planet. The mystery station was no closer to solving than it was when we retrieved the cylinder from Martian Street in 1969. Asking me what he should do. Abos, I said, looking straight back at him. You need to grow up. He didn't look away. Cress, you are my teacher still. I will learn this from you. He turned, then seemed to change his mind. May I kiss you, Cressida? Just kiss you. Diary. I kissed him. That's all I'm saying. Don't judge. When he left, I knew it was forever. I watched him from the window as he flew east, quickly hidden from sight in the darkness. That was a decade ago. No one has ever seen him again. Station paid me one visit in the weeks following his disappearance. It was an officer I've never seen before. He asked a few cursory questions. Carstairs had long since dismissed me as a threat. His mistake. One day, someone will read this. My fervent hope is that it won't be anyone from station, but someone who can use the information to expose what happened. I'm sure Abos will never allow himself to be controlled again, if he ever does reappear. But what of his children? One last secret, diary. Before he left, Abos asked me for a gift. One that I gave willingly. A gift that I will not reveal, even in these pages. Good luck, Abos. I miss you.
Chapter 39. What George had feared might take her weeks actually took minutes. She found information online about Cressida, even a photograph of her awarding prizes at a library in Clerkenwell. She dropped a message in the dark web to a hacker who seemed to live online. Within seconds, a response pinged back with Cressida Lofthouse's address. 10 minutes later, George was in the back of a taxi. She reached the leafy Clerkenwell Street at dusk, on a spring evening in 2013. As she approached the house, the front door opened, and a woman hurried down the steps. George slowed, but the woman was much too young to be Lofthouse. As they passed each other, George let her mind reach out, absorbing a little information. The woman was a military nurse, completing a shift. She had just handed over to a colleague. Cressida Lofthouse was inside, dying. George continued past the house. The impression she had just received was clear. There was no room for misinterpretation. Lofthouse was in the final stages of a rare disease. She was asleep, or in morphine-assisted unconsciousness much of the time, and was rarely lucid. George felt a flutter of panic. To have come this close to her best lead, and have so little time to do anything. She reached the end of the street and paused. She knew she couldn't afford to wait. The risk of Lofthouse dying was too great. Even now she might find nothing useful in the poor woman's mind. She turned her chair and headed back the way she had come. She eyed the elegant stone steps leading up to the front door of the house. Round the back as usual, then. She got as far as the lock gate. She looked up and down the street. It would be fully dark for a couple of hours, and a woman in a wheelchair sitting outside the gate was sure to be noticed, even on a street as quiet as this. She shrugged. It would take some effort, and she would undoubtedly feel the consequences for the next couple of days. But she couldn't be sure of ever getting another chance. She closed her eyes and let her mind drift. When she was in this state, she had to open her field of attention at first, encompassing as much as possible. That meant that anyone within half a mile might add a note to the music George was hearing. Once she had settled into this phase, she had a choice. She could widen the field, in which case far more minds contributed to the noise, but the information she received became more general. Or she could narrow it, capturing one or two minds and bringing a finer focus to bear. George found the new nurse, Andrew, and more faintly, and less coherently, the fevered ramblings of Cressida Lofthouse. They were both on the ground floor, which was an unexpected piece of good luck. Cressida's illness must have forced her to move her bed to the front room. George honed in on the nurse first and planted a simple idea. The more complicated an idea was, the more energy it demanded of her. She could have convinced the nurse there was an emergency which required him to run to the gate and let in a doctor. Or, as George chose to do, she could plant the idea that he had forgotten to leave the gate open for a delivery he was expecting. A simpler idea, using less energy. It took 12 minutes for him to act on it. While she waited, a man walking his dog paused and looked at her with the beginnings of concern. "Waiting for a cab," she called, waving her mobile phone as if that corroborated her story. The man walked on. 30 seconds later, George heard the sound of a bolt being drawn back. She waited another minute, then opened the gate and followed the wall around the French doors at the back of the house. There was a small step to negotiate by the door, but George pulled the wheelchair over it backwards. Her left hand had been getting weaker during the preceding months, but there was still enough strength left in it for her to complete the maneuver. As she waited in the kitchen, the door to the front room opened, and Andrew emerged, crossing to the sitting room where, thanks to George, he had decided to spend an hour lost in a book. George entered the front room. The curtains were closed, but a bedside light and a standard lamp made the room seem warm and comforting. A large bed dominated the space. Propped up against the pillows, her complexion so pale she almost disappeared against them, was Cressida Lofthouse. George had seen others close to death. There was an atmosphere around those whose ties to this world were stretching and breaking. George knew others felt it too, but it presented her with a problem. Cressida was lost in memories and dreams, rarely coming back to the world she would soon be leaving. George would have to interpret what she found in her mind and hope to glean something useful. She closed her eyes. After a few seconds, she reached out and took Cressida's hand. There was no need to establish a physical connection, but according to Major Harris's memories, this dying woman had been close to the deterrent. A friend, even. Holding Cressida's hand seemed like it was the right thing to do. Images, smells, sounds. A man pushing her up against the wall, his breath beer sour. An older man crying, pouring whiskey from a green bottle. A woman dying in this house. A daughter holding her father's hand, not knowing who was supporting who. A pair of eyes opening. Golden eyes. With a start, George looked at Cressida. She was awake. She was looking straight at her, her expression a mixture of surprise and awe. Cressida wet her lips, tried to speak. George took the glass of water from the bedside table and held it to her cracked lips. She sipped, then spoke, smiling. "You have his eyes." George blinked, the gold flecks in her deep brown eyes catching the glow of the lamp. Cressida's head fell back on the pillow. George reached into her mind and saw the deterrent floating outside a window, his helmet and goggles removed. She saw him put his hands on the trunk of a tree, heard him read words from a children's book. Then she felt him rip her nightdress. And then, as if Cressida knew she was there, she was suddenly presented with a pin-sharp series of images. A hamster in a shoebox being lifted into a cage. Cressida as a child, playing with the hamster, feeding it sunflower seeds, talking to it while she sat by her bedroom window. Then a tiny, furry body in a biscuit tin. And a wooden cross with a name laboriously carved into it in a child's hand. Mr. Biffles. A cough from the sitting room brought George back, and she backed out of the room, through the hall kitchen and into the garden, closing the door before Andrew crossed to the front room. Mr. Biffles? What could be so important about a dead hamster that would cause Cressida to fixate on it? The last few minutes had just been the same few images over and over on a constant loop. The hamster, the cross, the name, the biscuit tin. The hamster, the cross, something wasn't right. Something about the memory didn't quite ring true. George felt exhaustion starting to claim her as she sat in Cressida Lofthouse's garden, trying to work out what the dying woman had shown her. It was as she had turned back towards the gate that she realized. It was the biscuit tin. It was much too big. Why would you bury a tiny creature like a hamster in a biscuit tin? George swung around and went back to the garden. On the far side, just next to some rose bushes, was a tiny cross. From that distance, and in the failing light, George couldn't make out the letters carved there. But she didn't have to. Mr. Biffles. 15 minutes later, after Andrew had experienced an uncharacteristic urge to do some gardening, George was in the back of a taxi, so tired she could hardly keep her eyes open. She was clutching an earth-encrusted biscuit tin. She prized the lid open and took out the book inside. Unable to wait, she clicked on the internal light, opened the first page, and started reading. March 22nd, 2013. To whom it may concern, the notebooks you are holding comprise the diary I kept during the years since the discovery of Abos, the deterrent. Chapter 40. I had put the diary down and was staring out of the window again when George came back to the suite. She eased herself out of the wheelchair and onto the sofa, propping herself up against the cushions. Her smile was unforced. You know, I think I needed that. Station didn't even have Muzak playing. I've forgotten how lovely it is just listening to music. And it wasn't all songs from shows, thank goodness. He sneaked in a Dr. John number, so I was happy. I had no idea who she was talking about. She pointed at Cress's diary. Well, what do you think? I didn't know where to start. My father, George's father too, began as a blob of slime in a cylinder buried in London. He hadn't been born. He'd grown. What did that make the pair of us? Half hero made us sound cool. Half blob, not so much. I feel as if someone's answered a bunch of my questions, but given me twice as many. She nodded. That's pretty much how I felt when I read it. And, judging from Cress's account, even Abos may not have all the answers. You think he's alive, then? The deterrent? I do. So does Station. How can you be so sure? Because they've been looking for him for 35 years. I got myself into Station to break you out and steal all the information they had about Abos. All their theories, all the dead ends they'd already investigated and rejected. And did you succeed? Better than that. I copied the algorithm program they've been running for the past 5 years, based on their best guess at how Abos has been hiding. My guess is better. My leg was twitching. I knew my pulse rate was up. What do you mean? Can you bring me the laptop? I handed it over. She patted the seat next to her. I sat down while she clicked some keys. The screen showed a male face which changed to another after a split second. Then another man replaced that, followed by another. I had to look away after a few seconds as dozens of faces flicked by at a nauseating speed. What is that? George clicked again, and the images disappeared. That's Station's program. During the first decade of searching for the deterrent, they came up with a theory that might explain how the man with the most famous face in the world could hide. I said nothing. But she saw my expression and laughed. I'm getting there, Daniel. It's a facial recognition program. They rolled out an early version in the 1990s. But it was only 3 years ago that processing speed became fast enough to make it useful. You remember who Abos looked like. In the diary. Of course. That asshole, Roger. Exactly. His blood gave Abos enough genetic material to make a superior version, based on Roger Sullivan's DNA. They reasoned that to enable him to disappear, Abos might have pulled the same trick. I looked at her, my eyes boggling. I didn't know eyes actually did that. My mouth was dry. You mean, he might look like someone else now? Someone in the team? You've got it. They scanned photographs of every man who had worked with Abos. There was no record of any other opportunity for him to get blood. But perhaps a shaving cut or even a discarded plaster might have been enough. But couldn't he have got blood from someone outside Station? Yes. They are still adding faces to the database based on everyone they have records of him meeting. Everyone. But that could take years? Decades? Quite. They started with those who had the most contact with him, then widened the search. It's a long shot, Daniel. But they will keep exploring every possibility, however remote. Station is terrified Abos might reappear as a superhero affiliated to another country. They'll do anything to prevent that. One reason Station is so keen to find and capture us, the deterrent's children, is that they hope Abos might come looking for us one day. Do you think he will? I think Station is clutching at straws. They can't unravel Abos's motivations any more than we can. If they hadn't kept their pet superhero drugged, well, who knows? Maybe they would have understood him a little better. George grimaced as if in pain, but waved me away when I offered to help. It took 10 weeks for Abos to grow first time round. And he was in a cylinder then, whatever that was. No one knows if he can repeat the trick without the cylinder. It was just providing him with nutrients, then maybe he can. They've been running those faces through the program, but morphing the features, making them more symmetrical, removing blemishes. They've also artificially aged the faces. When Abos copied Sullivan, he appeared younger, as if he were in his 20s. If he did the same and then aged as normal, he might look like he's in his 50s now. I'd only known George for a couple of days, but the expression she had on her face could only be described as mischievous. What? I asked. What is it? What aren't you telling me? Come on, Daniel. You read the diary. All the clues are there. She practically spells it out. I groaned. Come on, George. Put me out of my misery. Where is he? What does he look like? You're asking the questions all wrong. For the first time in my life, I understood how siblings could fall out. George, please. Her expression became more serious. I'm coming to it, I promise. Daniel, I spent 3 weeks in station. I let Harris bring me in. She told me she wanted to help. She asked me why I was spending so much time investigating the deterrent. I told her I thought I might be his daughter. Then, as I'd hoped, they imprisoned me. Invited me to a meeting in a building near station. Drugged me and took me in. You planned for them to abduct you? Of course. They had to think they were in control. To them, I was an intriguing opportunity that had dropped into their laps. I couldn't let them suspect for a moment that I had any kind of power. They ran every test conceivable. They were desperate to find something, I think. Station is still looking for children like us, the ones who survived puberty. You're the poster boy. There must be others out there, but Station hasn't found them. I thought of the so-called terrorist cell I'd been set loose on. The blood on my hands from that day. I said nothing, but made a silent vow that if Station somehow recaptured me, I would kill myself before letting them use me again. I remembered my hands, wet with blood, round the throat of the red-haired woman who must have been my half-sister. George saw the look on my face and put a hand on my arm. I know what happened that night in Shoreditch. I couldn't have replied even if I wanted to. You feel terrible guilt and shame. I can't stop that. No one can. Intellectually, you know you are not responsible for their deaths. Station is. She waited until I nodded. Emotionally, though, you still feel responsible. Even though you were brainwashed and drugged, even though you were in a chemically induced state of rage, you still carry that guilt. Use it. Turn it into anger and use it against those who still want to control or kill us. I nodded again. There was a long silence. I asked what had happened to her inside station. I didn't need to be a mind reader to see how excited the scientific team were to meet me. It took about 10 days before the disappointment set in. They didn't find your power. No. By the time they had concluded the tests, they thought it was likely that some inherited ability may have begun to manifest at puberty. But my body had been too weak to withstand its onset. They think my illness is the result. They all felt a bit sorry for me. Nice of them. Yes, well, by then I had time to sneak into a dozen minds. I was planting ideas in various brains for weeks, leading up to your escape. Shifts were rearranged, a few people called in sick, and security staff looked the wrong way while we walked out. I also had a data guy drop me an email with a link to the online search program. He included details of the back door he'd programmed. I was able to copy and adapt it. Well, not me. My hacker. You're amazing, I said. I'm constantly underestimated, she said. Station underestimated Crest too. Hopkins has built an appalling patriarchy down there. It's his greatest weakness. Well, that and halitosis. And the deterrent. Abos, you were about to tell me, nearly there. George, wait. This is important. I took a deep breath to stop myself banging my head against the wall, which would erect some very expensive wallpaper. Was that real gold flake in the design? The hybrid program hit a limitation years ago. They can't get hybrids to live past one or two missions before their bodies collapse. Their physical development is accelerated through growth hormones from the time they're fetuses. But even an enhanced physique can't withstand the damage when they are sent into action. They're berserkers, I said, remembering my encounter with the Tweedles. They run on pure rage. They want to kill everything in their path. Their lack of predictability and their short lifespan makes them a bad bet for the military. The funding is being withdrawn next summer. I got that from Hopkins himself. You were in his mind. Ugh. Not somewhere I ever want to revisit. But I needed information, and I planted an urgent appointment on the other side of town the day we escaped. Daniel, he's not shutting down the program. He's contacted some private investors. Hopkins. Going against orders. He wouldn't. He's convinced himself it's in the best interest of his country to keep the hybrids. He plans on breeding an army. He thinks he'll be seen as a hero, not a traitor, when the truth comes out. Which he's delusional, yes. But he's also persuasive and dangerous. He sees this as his legacy. We need to close down the hybrid project before he moves all the research and data elsewhere. His paranoia will come in useful for once. Everything is held in station, and the computer network is a closed system. We destroy that, we destroy the project. She stopped talking. Finally. George! I was almost shouting. You still haven't told me. You found our father, haven't you? Where is he? Who is he? What does he look like now? She gave me an odd look. What? One more thing. You're going back to station, Daniel. Tonight. I'm what? You're going to destroy it. Excuse me, what? You know the layout. You know where the hybrids are. Hopkins will be there, but this evening, he's sending half of station staff to help flush out suspected terrorist organizations in Kent. That will help. Your work? Of course. She looked even more frail than she had the day before. If using her power exhausted her physically and shortened her lifespan, the past few months of pursuing station, getting in there and arranging my escape, then setting the stage for tonight, well, it must have taken a hell of a toll. She would need a long rest after this, especially as I was about to let her down. I don't think of myself as a coward, but walking back into station would be suicide. George, I can't fight hybrids. I took on two of them 14 years ago, and I only just survived. They will be stronger, faster, tougher now. And there will be more of them. They'll tear my legs off and use them to crush my skull. But you won't be alone. Abos will come with you. At last, I felt my heart lurch. Where is he? George handed me a piece of paper with an address on it. My hands were shaking. What's this? My flat. Take a taxi. Abel should be there by now. Go have a chat. Come back after the two of you have wiped out that horror show Hopkins is running. I brushed imaginary dust off the collar of the gorgeous suit, feeling suddenly terrified. This was it. I was going to meet the deterrent. The disappearing superhero. My father. And, assuming he still had the same powers, taking station down suddenly seemed imminently possible. George, what about you? Come with me. I don't come with you, she said. It took me a few moments to work out what she meant. Your power. I thought you couldn't be that specific. This time I can be. What happens today has been very clear for a long time. I don't go with you. I wait here. There's something I need to do, too. George fell silent for a second, then spoke so quietly I could barely hear her. It has to happen the way I saw it if we're going to win. If we change anything, we might fail. She held out her arms, and I hugged her for a few seconds. She was crying. I'll bring him to see you, I said, giving her as gentle a squeeze as I could manage. We can have a family meeting. She laughed a little at that, still choked with sobs. Then she lightly pushed me away and waved me towards the door. "See you later," I said as I walked out. All my thoughts focused on the meeting ahead. Much later, I thought back to that moment and remembered that she hadn't replied. George was the one who could see the future. Me? Not a chance. Even when it's blindingly obvious. I went downstairs, got in a taxi, and drove off to meet my dad. Chapter 41. George's flat was on the ground floor of an imposing Edwardian terrace within sight of Putney Bridge. I paid the taxi driver with a 50 and let him keep the change. He was gruffly grateful, eyeing my suit and probably assuming money meant little to me. My generosity was down to expediency. If I waited for change, I might lose my nerve. I was shaking, my mind skipping from half-formed thought to half-formed thought like a butterfly on crack. I found I could only function if I allowed myself to complete one simple task at a time. Open the taxi door, step onto the pavement, close the taxi door, walk across the pavement to the front door, push the buzzer on the door, stare at the door as it swings open under the pressure of my finger on the buzzer. I could smell freshly baked bread. I stepped into a wide hallway with a tiled floor. A reproduction of Picasso's Guernica hung on the wall. There were doors off the hallway. The two doors on the right and the door on the left were shut, but the one ahead, at the end of the hall, was open. It led to a brightly lit kitchen, where a figure moved across my line of sight. I willed my feet to move, or my voice to speak, only to discover that my brain was the victim of a coup. I remained dumb, rooted to the spot. A voice called out from the kitchen. "You must be Daniel. Come on in, I'm just making a cup of tea and George has got some of that posh honey that costs a fortune. You have to try it on toast, it's smashing." My feet belatedly accepted my earlier instruction and started to move as my brain clunkily processed what was wrong about the voice. Two things. A Welsh accent was one of them. The other, which was confirmed as I walked into the kitchen, was that it belonged to a woman. I went straight to the table and put both hands on the back of a solid oak chair to stop me falling over. Standing with her back to me was a tall woman with short grey hair, wearing dark jeans and a thick blue woolly jumper. She was cutting bread into slices. A teapot sat on the counter, steam curling from its spout, two mugs next to it. She turned and smiled at me. "Hello, Daniel." She looked to be in her mid-60s. Her face was lined, her brown eyes surrounded by creases that deepened as she smiled. It was a kind face, a gentle face, a maternal face. It was also, unmistakably, the face I'd seen in a photograph a few hours previously, although she had been 19 or 20 in the picture. It was the face of a dead woman. "Hello," I said, because I didn't know what else to say. It was Cressida Lofthouse. We drank tea, and I tried the toast. She was right, the honey was excellent. Eventually, I found my voice. "You're not Cressida Lofthouse?" "No, love, I'm not. George told me she had died. I was very sorry to hear it. Cressida was a very special person." "Then you're..." "Yes. Yes, I am." The woman who looked like Cressida took a small case out of the bag at her feet and put her hands up to her face. She removed her contact lenses and placed them in the case before looking back at me. Her eyes were golden. "Hey, boss," I said. "Yes. Well, I've been known as Amy since 1981. But yes, your father, or mother, maybe parent would be easiest. Pleased to meet you." We shook hands. In a life not devoid of surreal moments, this one took the proverbial biscuit. I was sitting in the kitchen of the mind-reading half-sister I had never known, shaking hands with my father, who was now a woman, although not really, as she wasn't human. George emailed me a week ago, said Amy. Amos. Dad. The deterrent.